Hey, good morning. It's Patricia Murphy. It's Wednesday. This is Seattle Now. Stable, permanent housing. It's at the heart of every long-term solution to the city's homelessness crisis. In a minute, KUOW's Casey Martin will tell us how it happened for one Seattle man who'd been homeless for more than a decade. But first, let's get you caught up. Renters will get a few more months of protection from the city's eviction ban that was set to expire next week. Yesterday, Mayor Durkan announced an executive order extending the moratorium through January 15th. It's the sixth extension since March 2020, and the state's rental housing industry is done with this. They criticized the city for creating what it called a housing crisis of its own making and say forever eviction bans are racking up debt for residents and driving single-family rentals off the market. Meanwhile, King County is getting ready to help house the first wave of Afghan refugees. Yep, they're already starting to arrive in western Washington. Part of the plan includes putting some people up at a Federal Way hotel the county bought earlier this year. There's also $500,000 to pay for language services and emergency grants for community groups that are working to get people settled. And it's the end of an era. After 37 years, the state will be shutting down the 764 Hero Hotline. That's where drivers report HOV lane cheaters and ferry line cutters. The line goes off the hook today. The outlet for citizen lane monitors has been around since 1984. There was even a local band named after it. WashDOT says the highway signs will come down and be replaced with signs warning drivers about fines. The State Patrol plans to have more presence at ferry terminals to discourage the awful people who try to cut the line, who we can all agree are the worst. Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan announced this week the city has bought three new apartment buildings to help house people experiencing homelessness. The newly built studio apartments were actually built with tech workers in mind, but now they're for the formerly homeless. It's not the first time it's been done in the city. In fact, a similar building opened earlier this year. Reporter Casey Martin went to find out what was going on, and he's here now. Hey, Casey, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Murph, thanks.
So, often we talk about what's not working, but it sounds like in this story, it is working. People are getting housing. Why did you want to pursue this?
Well, you know, a couple of reasons I wanted to do a story about somebody who is making it work, because I think a lot of homelessness coverage, including my own, I'm talking to a lot of folks that are in crisis, folks that are still living in tents, that are unable to connect with services, and I think there's a big need to hear from folks that are actually getting into housing. And it's certainly a small group of people. It's certainly not most folks who are experiencing homelessness. But there are some people who are getting into housing. And in this case, a really, really good home for someone who's been waiting on one for a long time.
So this is a success story, Casey. Tell me who you met up with when you visited.
Yeah, I met Bob Williamson. He's 65 years old. He's a veteran. Bob's been homeless for the past 10 years, and during that entire time, he's been trying to find housing. He is a good example of someone who's just kind of gone through this process for these past 10 years and jumped through the hoops in those past 10 years to go from a tent to an apartment.
You know, Casey, this is so many people's story, the resilience and the fortitude you have to navigate the system to get some kind of housing is significant. What did Bob share with you about how he got here?
Yeah, so Bob originally, he used to live in a tent out on his own, and he just kind of traveled around Seattle finding security. He lived under a bridge for a while. And in 2016, the city opened up a spot for people like Bob to pinch his tent. This was a legal, sanctioned tent camp approved by the city. It was near Inner Bay, right on the water on Dravis Avenue.
It used to be called Tent City 5.
One of those tent cities that we've seen throughout Seattle. And this was Bob's first kind of real step on the housing ladder. This was kind of how he got introduced to maybe how he could get closer to a housing situation, you know, farther away from his tent. And, you know, it was also the first time that he had community. You know, originally he was living by himself. Now he has neighbors. They're living in tents. They had a little kitchen space that they could share. And they also had a check-in person so they could kind of keep an eye on things. So there was a little bit of security. And this was a big deal for Bob. He says he had that security that he never had at a large shelter.
And I needed a place like that because I was working late. Those daytime shelters, they're no good. They kick you out at 5 o'clock in the morning, and then you got to take all your stuff with you. Well, how are you supposed to show up on a construction site with all your belongings with you every day? You know, It just don't work. You can't do it.
Tent City 5, it wasn't just a safe place for him to sleep. It was also a place where he got a case manager through the city, and that was a big deal for him. That was somebody who could help him find work. He got a job at a restaurant working nights. That case manager helped him catch up on his health. You know, he's a veteran, so he was able to show up to his VA appointments. And while he was at Tent City 5, he was there for over a year. And then suddenly, him and the entire Tent City, they get this huge upgrade. They're all moved right down the road to tiny houses. They each get their own little tiny house. So they're swapped out of a tent camp into a tiny house.
Tiny houses were great, you know. I don't know, like I said, I don't know where I'd ended up. It wouldn't have been pretty if I hadn't gotten into one. Because how was I supposed to go to work? How was I supposed to get my shit together, you know? I couldn't do it out of a day shelter, you know. Those overnight shelters, they're a joke.
He was living a stable life. He was working a job. He didn't have any complaints or any issues with the tiny house. And his case manager kind of wanted to move him along. He kind of wanted to get him into an apartment because they wanted to free up his tiny house for somebody else to come in and, you know, get out of a tent. So eventually his case manager started showing him around other apartments.
He tried to get me to move into a couple other places that I just wasn't going to move into, you know, shared kitchens and shared bathrooms and I said, that ain't moving into it. I got that right here. Why do I want to do that, you know?
He didn't want to do it. His case manager, you know, he drives him around town. He shows him all these, you know, pretty nice one-bedroom apartments. He does have, you know, shared facilities, like he says. But he doesn't want any of them. He just wants to stay in his tiny house.
And I think this gets at something important here about autonomy and decision-making when you're homeless. Why was Bob reluctant to leave his tiny house?
You know, when I asked him about this, you know, because I visited some of these tiny house villages, and I've been to the one at Inner Bay, and it's a gravel lot with a chain link fence. And, you know, at first glance, you might think that it is just transitional housing, that somebody wouldn't want to stay there long term. And Bob kind of broke it down to me that, you know, he had his own nice little space. And this, you know, for a lot of folks, to kind of get your first four walls, this was brand new to him. He loved having a door. He loved having actually a solid bed. And the idea of having to change that, having to leave and to go to someplace unknown, like anybody, kind of resistant to that. Another big deal was community. A lot of folks that he lived in that tiny house village with were folks that he used to live in the tent city with. So it was just neighbors. He didn't want to meet new people. He had folks that he liked, that he trusted, that he lived with, you know, at that point for like 3 years. So he wasn't just going to pack up and leave all that behind.
And he did eventually find a place, Casey.
He did. He did find a place. His hardworking case manager finally finds this place called The Clay. It's a brand new apartment building. It's right on Capitol Hill. It opened up in February, and it's a nice, nice building. One of those skinny buildings that kind of just shoots straight up. You've seen the type.
I've seen them.
And the building was originally built not for Bob, but for tech workers, for people coming in, you know, who work downtown and want a fancy place to live on Capitol Hill.
So, Casey, how did an empty building built for tech workers end up becoming affordable housing?
Yeah, so these were originally one-bedroom studios designed for folks, you know, who were making good money. They wanted to live in the city. But this past year, with remote working, tech workers, they didn't have to move to Seattle for all these new jobs. They could just stay wherever they were. So a lot of these new building projects in Seattle, like The Clay, they've had trouble finding renters. In this case, the builders decided to just sell the whole building. And they did, to the Low Income Housing Institute here in Seattle.
So Bob's there in a situation he actually never thought he would be in.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get a tour?
I did get a tour, and it's a nice place. I mean, these were supposed to rent out for like $3,500 a month. Brand new furnishings, lots of windows, you know, little tile work everywhere. And Bob shows me around, and he actually kept surprising me with all these little details around the building.
But this is nice. We got a park up on the top floor, you know.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, it's really nice. You got a view of the whole city.
Really?
You know, Casey, it really sounds like Bob has found a safe, comfortable place to live. And I'm curious if he shared with you what it actually means for him to be here in this place.
You know, we sat outside up on that rooftop for a while, and Bob talks about that, you know, he's getting older. He's 65 years old. He's a veteran. And he kept telling me, he goes, you know, I'm ready to retire. And, you know, he's been, you know, originally living in a tent and then in a tiny house. And for him, he loves it. He loves having a place that's secure. He can go up an elevator. He can chat with neighbors throughout the building. Everybody that we passed, everybody knew his name he was talking to. And you do see somebody that he does, he's kind of ready to relax. And there's this feeling that when I talk to a lot of folks that are experiencing homelessness, there's this tension that they aren't able to relax. There isn't this sense of security that they're able to completely relax. And for Bob, you definitely get that feeling.
It's great to hear this story, but again, I feel like we need to add a results not typical warning on this in some ways, because as we speak, there are a significant number of people struggling with homelessness and trying to navigate the very system that put Bob in this place.
Absolutely. You know, the vast majority of people experiencing homelessness, in Seattle and King County, that's about 12,000 people. They are not getting into these nice rooms at the Clay. There are day shelters and there are more hotel beds that are opening up. But apartments, they take a really long time to get into. And, you know, as you said, it's a long process you have to navigate. A big reason that Bob was able to get his place is he is a veteran. So this particular, set of rooms had rooms specifically slated for homeless veterans. Also, a big help for Bob was that case manager that we talked about. A big thing that I talk about with folks who are experiencing homelessness is, where do you show up, for a particular appointment, or what service provider are you supposed to call? It's a long, complicated process with different email addresses, different phone calls. And for Bob, he had this case manager that really kind of helped him along the way to take him from that tent to the tiny house and to this apartment. So he certainly didn't do it alone. And it took many years to get to where he is today.
Yes. And, there are many, many caseworkers working hard in a very difficult system. Casey, this is not the only building of its kind. Williamson and his 70 so neighbors are in a good space, but there are other low-income buildings that are being obtained by the city for this.
Yeah, that's right. Seattle is trying to do more of this, kind of steer away from those large congregate shelters and find private rooms that people really, really enjoy and people stay in long-term. As you said at the top, the city just announced this week that they bought 3 more buildings. These are just like the Clay. These are brand new units. They're newly built. And those will house about 165 people. King County is also doing something similar. They're buying up motels to house people. They're a little less popular because those hotel rooms, I've seen them, they don't have kitchens. And so you can't really cook your own food. So that's kind of a complication. But people stay in them, so it's kind of working. Also, tiny house villages, like the tiny house village that Bob came from, those are actually growing. People love those, just like Bob did. Those are expanding all over the city. But of course, as you mentioned, it's worth repeating that 12,000 people in Seattle and King County, they do not have stable housing. They're living in an RV or a car or in and out of a shelter, and it's not a stable situation at all. The people getting these nice apartments are just a kind of a small sliver of the population.
Yeah. And those 12,000 people, what's the plan? We still have no comprehensive plan, Casey?
Well, that's kind of that's the big question. This is a large regional issue and different cities are taking different approaches. The big question is, if Seattle can open up apartments fast enough, they're buying up 1 or 2 buildings here and there, if they can send out outreach workers to connect to these 12,000 people living in tents and RVs, and if they can provide wraparound services, because housing isn't just the only option. It's not the only issue. We're also talking about mental health treatment, addiction counseling, job and school training. If that kind of wraparound services can go to where people are, that's kind of the big question right now.
Well, Casey, it's great to hear about Bob and his neighbors getting some peace of mind. Appreciate your coverage. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Jason Bigano produced today's show with editing help from Jeannie Yandel. Our production team is Caroline Chamberlain Gomez, Claire McGrain, Diana Opong, and Jenny Cecil Moore. Matt Jorgensen does our theme music. I'm Patricia Murphy.